get started now that we've got the computer up and running and get some of our texts up on the screen. My name is Carla Sula and I teach at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. As I've mentioned before, I teach in biblical studies, especially Hebrew Bible or Old Testament and Judaism. But being at a liberal arts college and being awfully curious, I get to teach and put myself into all kinds of other interesting courses throughout my time there. So at Luther College, I have taught two January terms. We have a month-long January term course in Ghana in West Africa, which has been really fascinating. It's looked at Christianity and the slave trade. One January term, I went with a colleague to London to do a course on players and playwrights. So my task was to go with a colleague and 22 students to see 17 plays during the course of a month. It was so taxing. And not only that, we were forced to go a week in the fall to preview many of those plays. Oh. Yeah, so, you know, sometimes you get those really difficult assignments. But it was a fantastic kind of course. I haven't taught a January term abroad, but I'm getting one ready right now to teach with a colleague in the art department. It's a brand new course on the books, and it'll come out of the religion department. And it's been something I've been really interested in teaching for a long time. It's called From the Middle Ages to the Holocaust, Jews and Judaism in Europe. And so we're taking a look at different slices of lived Judaism in different parts of Europe, as well as looking at what happened to European Jewry during the Holocaust. And so it's got a pretty fantastic itinerary just in terms of getting a sense. The problem with a course like that is just narrowing it down. So our schedule this coming January will be about 5 days in Amsterdam, a week in Berlin, a day or two in Wittenberg, and then we'll head over to Prague for another 5 days, and then end up in Krakow. So not a bad, and then looking at three different concentration camps on that side of the trip. So those are the kinds of things I get to do. I've also taught courses that deal with Islam. And today, that's what we're going to be looking at in here. How does Eve, and the story of Eve and Adam, get translated, or how is it dealt with within the Islamic tradition? Of the traditions that I've dealt with so far this week, we've taken a look at the biblical text itself on Monday. We looked at Christian traditions on Tuesday. We looked at Jewish traditions yesterday. The Islamic tradition is probably the least familiar to people, or perhaps about the same as Judaism. Sometimes people have a sense that they know more about Judaism, but Islam, usually when I've taught, people haven't had an opportunity to look at some texts. So we're going to take a look at some of these Islamic Muslim texts today and take a look at, we're going to sort of move into the modern period. Where do we go from here? So it's Eve versus the people, the appeal. Before we get started on some of these texts, in terms of looking at what they actually say, I want to give you a little background, as I did with Judaism, in terms of how these texts work. Give you a little background on the Quran, that sort of thing, so we kind of know what we're getting into, some dates, that sort of thing. So today, we have the MIA, the Muslim Intelligence Agency, on the scene. We've had the CPD, the Christian Police Department. We have had the RSI, the Rabbinic Site Investigators, and today it's the MIA. All right. We're going to be taking a look at it through a couple different lenses within the Muslim tradition, the Quran, which is the 7th century of the Common Era, and then we're going to take a look at some later commentaries or compilations of stories, and they're going to sound a lot like some of the things that we did yesterday, but these are Islamic, and one of them in particular is a 13th century compilation of legends about some of these figures. So what are the lenses? Every day when we've been coming to these texts, we take a look and we say, okay, how is this particular crew of investigators looking at the scene? All right. What kinds of things do they have going around in their heads? What's going on with them as they look at the scene? So, the Quran is critical to understanding the kinds of assumptions or lenses that they bring with them to the scene. And I want to talk just a moment about what the Quran is, the most sacred text of Islam. So, and the highest authority in both religious and legal matters. All right. So, in many ways, very similar to the role that the Bible plays in Christianity. All right, especially within Protestant Christianity. Probably the next in line after the Quran is a term perhaps people have heard before, hadith. Has anybody heard that? That word. At any rate, if you look to the Quran first and then you look at hadith, what hadith means are the sayings and actions of the Prophet Muhammad that have been recorded. All right? So you look to what he did and what he said. And it's more complicated than that, but that's the general idea. And then there are many other kinds of commentaries and that sort of thing, just in the same way that you find within Christianity and Judaism. All right, so you've got your foundational texts, and then they expand from there as people comment and discuss them throughout the ages. So Muslims believe the Quran to be a flawless record of the angel Gabriel's revelations to Muhammad from the years 610 CE to 632, or CE and AD, as I mentioned before, are interchangeable. They're just different ways of making the same notation. And this is really, really important because the text of the Quran is then very, very different than the kind of text that you have within Judaism and Christianity. If you take a look at the Jewish Bible and then the Christian Bible, these are texts that were compiled over hundreds of years by many, many different authors, and so have a much different sort of feel. What's important to realize about the Quran is that really it takes place in a very short amount of time, all right? It was then committed to memory by some of Muhammad's closest followers shortly after, and not committed to memory, but written down. It was committed to memory during his lifetime, written down shortly after his death. All right. So this is the style. All those sorts of things are going to be very different and actually a lot more coherent in terms of approach than, you know, biblical text has got all these different kinds of texts in it. You don't see necessarily that wide variety within the Quran. It deals with a wide variety of topics, but the styles aren't as widely varying. And it's all in Arabic. All right. Just for point of reference, 622, in the middle of that period, actually marks year one in the Islamic calendar, right? So when you see, you know, dates, and they date it to the Muslim calendar, year one is 622, which makes perfect sense because their entire calendar is based on the Christian calendar, what we thought of year one, Jesus, all right? The Quran's name is derived from Gabriel's initial command to Muhammad, recite. All right, that's what the word Quran means, recite. In Arabic, recitation of the Quran as oral text, is absolutely critical, all right, to Islam, okay? If you've traveled in an Islamic country, you will recognize this aspect, this recitation. I just came back from 3 weeks in Egypt. I arrived back shortly before coming to Holden. And throughout the day, you can hear during the call for prayer and at different, and especially on Fridays, you can hear recitations of the Quran. When I was in taxis, it was on the radio. Hearing the Quran and memorizing it is still very, very important to Islamic culture, Muslim culture. So the first followers of the Prophet, that's Muhammad, memorized his recitation in order to recite it to others. And this is what has long been done in Arabic poetry. A little bit more about the Quran. It's about the length of the New Testament, all right? So not particularly long. It's divided into 114 surahs. A surah is the Arabic word for chapter, all right? Each of which is broken up into verses. A verse is called an ayat, okay? Now, what's interesting is how the Quran is arranged, all right? It's not chronological. It's based on the longest chapter or surah to the shortest. So when you look at the first one, it's many pages. If you pick up, and a Quran is, you know, you can get it easily within one volume. Like I said, it's the size of the New Testament. So it goes from longest, and then the last chapter is like a paragraph, right? Now what's kind of interesting is that these shorter chapters actually seem to date from the earlier part of the revelation to Muhammad. And so if you want to know what sort of was revealed in what order, you kind of have to start at the end and move forward. It doesn't work perfectly, but that, you know, chronology is interesting. Now the very same thing is true in the biblical text. Often students in my intro to Bible classes have the sense that Genesis was written first and then Exodus, and we have to go through and say, no, this is really complicated, really, really complicated. They weren't in the order, written in the order that they're placed in that text. All right, and even the creation stories that we're dealing with, we talked about there being two creation stories in the Bible. There's the first one that has in the beginning and has the 7 days, all right? That was written later. Right. The second creation story, Genesis 2 and 3, was written earlier, all right? So in a lot of these ancient texts, chronology and the way we think of it wasn't their central concern, all right? Each surah or chapter has a heading, all right? Which usually incorporates some of the elements, so like a title. So today, one of the first texts we'll be reading is from The Cow, is the name of one of the longest chapters in the Quran. The Bee is another one, all kinds of names. And usually they're based on a prominent word, usually at the beginning of the surah or somewhere in it, all right? But it doesn't necessarily represent all of its contents, all right? In the Jewish tradition, the names of the books in Hebrew are assigned similarly, all right, the way that they are in the Quran. We call the first 5 books of the Bible, for example, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. But in the Jewish tradition, Genesis is called Bereshit, which means in the beginning, all right. Exodus is called Bamidbar, in the wilderness, all right, which captures. So they're named after different sorts of things. Each of these surahs also has a prayer formula at the beginning, basmala, in the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, all right? You always have that sort of beginning each chapter, and sometimes you have an indication as to whether this revelation was received at Mecca or Medina, two of the places in Arabia where Muhammad was. Now, some things you need to know about reading the Quran, all right? Most of the Quran is written in the first person plural. So as we go through this, you're going to say, what is all this we business? Because it'll say, we created, we did this. And one of the first reactions I always get is like, are they polytheistic? Like, who's the we business? They have, in Islam, there is the sense that God has so many attributes that you can't just sort of condense God to one. Right? So there is only one God in Islam, all right, Allah, okay? And by the way, Muslims don't worship Muhammad. He is a prophet, and they're very clear on that, okay? In the same way that Christians and Jews have prophets. So, but you, when we see this we kind of thing, it means God, all right? Just to kind of your code for today. When Muhammad himself speaks, his words are introduced by say. Because that kind of indicates that God has commanded him to do that. And a note about the word or term Allah for God, it is precisely the same root as the word used for God in the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible. Elohim comes from the same root. All right? Because Hebrew and Arabic are Semitic languages. They share a lot of similar structures. The vocabulary of the Quran is almost entirely Arabic, but there are some from words from Hebrew, all right, and Syriac cultures, okay, and both of which Muhammad was familiar with, all right. Before I get to any questions on anything I've said there, anything that makes sense? Okay. Next, worldview or assumptions. We talk about some of the sorts of things. That's one of their lenses. They're looking through it, the Quran as most significant in their tradition. What can we say about these Muslim investigators? All right. They're influenced by Jews and Christians in and around Arabia. So Muhammad knew Jews and Christians, and there were Jewish and Christian communities there, right? Influenced to such an extent that many of the characters that are familiar to us through the Bible have become part of the Quran. It's not entirely clear that Muhammad knew how to read and write, so a lot of these stories probably came to him orally. All right, so sometimes people ask, well, why are these changed so much? Well, it's interesting. If they're passed orally, that might be one of the reasons. But he knew of them. So figures like Moses and Job and Joseph, there's a whole chapter in the Quran. It's called the Joseph chapter, or Joseph surah. It's the whole story of Joseph that we see in the book of Genesis. All right? So pieces like that. Another interesting piece about the Quran is that it actually has more discussions and mentions Mary, the mother of Jesus, more than the New Testament does, which a lot of people are surprised to hear. As I mentioned before, Muhammad is a prophet, just like Jesus or Joseph or Moses, but in Islam, he's considered the final prophet. Okay? Muslims consider Jews and Christians and themselves, Muslims, all to be people of the book, is what they call them, and children of Abraham. Right? So sometimes that's why we say Abrahamic traditions, that's what we mean, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, or people of the book, referring to those traditions. What kinds of things do they assume? Some of the things are very, very similar to what we've seen in Christianity and as well as in Judaism during the same era. Death and resurrection, all right? They have a sense of heaven and hell, sense of angels and demons, just like we saw yesterday in the Jewish text. They have a sense of final judgment, all right? So not so different than many of their Jewish and Christian counterparts during this time period, and even still today. All right, we're going to start with the creation of man and woman in the garden. They don't really specify as clearly as Eden, but we're going to take a look at this passage where we first start having mentioned. If you look in the lower right-hand corner, it says the cow. That's the name of the chapter, all right? And it's verses 29 and 30. 2 is actually the number of the chapter, so it's sort of double. I could have just put 2, colon 29 and 30, or the cow, 29 and 30. But you do it just so you can find the numbers a little more quickly, all right? So if your Lord said to the angels, right. I am placing a deputy on earth, they said. Will you put someone who will cause trouble there and shed blood? And while we sing your praise and glorify you, God said, I know what you do not know. Very similar to yesterday, conversation with the angels. All right, I'm putting a deputy on earth. The angels are like, we sing your praises all day long. You're putting somebody there who's going to cause all this trouble. All right, God says, I'm doing it. Here we have that, I talked about the we business, and we created you and formed you, and then we said to the angels, bow to Adam. Sound familiar? Yes, they were neighbors. Bow to the angel, bow to Adam, and they bowed, except Iblis. Really important word for today, Satan. That's Satan, that's the word they used, the name for Satan. Who was not one of those who bowed, God said to Iblis, what prevented you from bowing when I commanded you? Iblis said, I am better than he is. He said, you created me of fire, but you created him of clay. God said, then descend from here. It is not for you to exalt yourself here. Get out. You are among the vile. You see the seeds. Now, these Muslim investigators now have what as they investigate the crime in Eden, or the garden?
They have a motive.
They got a motive. It was going on long before. We've got a backstory here that you need to know. They've got motive. Iblis said, oh, wait a minute. Grant me respite until the day they are resurrected. There's this sense in the Islamic text, very much like the Jewish text, that they can jump back and forward in time and that they have a sense of the future. God said, you shall be of those granted respite. So he was like, yes, I'll do that. Iblis said, then in view of the fact that you have made me stray, who's he blaming? You've made this happen. I will lie in wait for them on your righteous path, and I intend to come upon them to their faces and behind their backs and from their right and their left, and you will not find most of them grateful to you. So he's speaking here both about the first couple as well as humans in general. I will be there, he says. Yep.
Sounds awfully much like Job, the beginning of Job.
It does. I'm just like watching out, kind of going here and there.
In a sense that I'll show you that they won't last.
They won't last. And they're not going to be thankful to you. God said, get out of here, despised and rejected. Indeed, if any of them follow you, I will fill hell with you all. So there's a little debate between God and Satan before the whole thing gets underway. But you, Adam, dwell in the garden, you and your wife, and eat whatever you want. But do not come near this tree. How is this different than the biblical? But when he says this tree, it seems as like they're pointing it out. It's not clear that it says the trees in the middle of the garden. And they're kind of clarifying that. Lest you become abusive oppressors. I don't want you to become tyrants. Then Iblis whispered to them, suggestions to expose to them their shame. Kind of like to show them who they really were. So this is a little bit different idea than what we've encountered before, which had been hidden from them and said, your Lord has only forbidden you this tree lest you become angels or immortals. And he swore to them, I am a sincere advisor to you, right? So he made the two fall by means of vain hope. And when they tasted the tree, their shame was exposed to them, and they began to sew together leaves from the garden to cover themselves. And their Lord called to them, did I not forbid you that tree and tell you the Iblis is clearly opposed to you? They said, oh, Lord, we have oppressed ourselves, and if you do not forgive us and have mercy on us, we will surely be lost. What do you notice so far in terms of differences between what we've seen in the biblical text and specifically in the Christian tradition? What do you notice?
No blame.
What?
No blame.
No blame.
They're blaming themselves. They're not blaming others.
And they ask for forgiveness.
They ask for forgiveness right away. What else?
Well, and their shame was already there, but just not apparent to them. They were already possessed of the shame. They just didn't see it.
They just didn't know. What else is similar? Or any different?
They tie themselves back into God. Without that mercy, we're going to be lost from you, where Adam and Eve leave the garden.
There is a, what else?
Well, Eve doesn't eat the fruit either. There's no, like, Eve ate of the fruit and then gave it to Adam. They tasted it.
She is not...
She's not even mentioned as a...
As the perpetrator.
Yeah.
Who seems to be the biggest villain in all of this?
Iblis.
Yeah. He really takes on that role, which is kind of interesting when you think about it. A very different take on this. God said, descend, enemies of one another. There is for you. And so they are sort of expelled from this garden. There is for you a dwelling on earth and provisions for a while. God said, there you will live and there you will die, but you will be taken out of there eventually. So earth becomes this sort of place where they go. Then Adam received instruction from his Lord, and God relented toward him, for God is most relenting and merciful. So they went back for more instructions.
In the first line, what is enemies of one another?
That's that sort of enmity between them. You're going to have some trouble with each other, as humans and as a couple. But it didn't say Eve is the cause of all of those issues, which is kind of interesting. A lot of this is addressed in the second person plural, so you, meaning you and you.
Are they enemies of each other, or is Iblis their joint enemy?
In another text, they make it clear that Iblis is also one of the enemies. So in this one, it is ambiguous because God started out speaking to Adam. But there's another text that does actually make that clarification and brings Iblis into it. So, yeah, that's a good question. So it's probably, you know, depending on which one you take a look at, it can involve the Satan. That's really the first piece. Now, what else does it say about them? That's the sort of main structure. Those verses in a number of different ways are repeated about four different times or pieces of them throughout the Quran. I just took the fullest version for you, the one that gave you the sense. But yeah, that's what you find. What else do you find out from the Quran about this first couple? O humanity, be reverent toward your God who created you from one soul and created its mate from it, and from these two disseminated many men and women. Be reverent toward God by whom you ask of each other, and be reverent toward relationships, for God is watching over you. So it's the sense that they're made from one soul, men and women, all right, and that they are spread out throughout the earth. Be reverent to each other, toward God, talking about human relationships in general.
There's not a sense of hierarchy as men
right.
being above
yeah.
them.
They seem more equal. In these they do, all right? And I have to always, you know, say, take it with a grain of salt, because there are other texts that certainly will, you know, knock us down on that. But there a lot of these stories, are far more equal than you might expect. Partnership and diversity, another aspect of Eden. And among the signs of God is this: He created all of you from dust. How's that different? Right. And there you are, humankind spreading widely. And among the signs of God is this, so another sign: He created mates for you from yourselves that you may feel at home with them. And God put love and kindness between you. Surely that is a sign for reflective people. And among the signs of creation is the creation of the heavens and the earth and the diversity of your languages and complexions. Surely in that is a sign for the knowing. It's kind of, what do you think?
The book is called Rome.
Yeah, it's, part of the word Rome appears in there, so. What were you saying?
Oh, I was saying it's very beautiful. It's
yeah.
it's very egalitarian and it's all sort of like love and sunshine and respect each other and especially like the part about the diversity of your languages and complexions, uh-huh. like no matter who you are or where you're from or what language you speak, we're all God's children and we should all love and respect each other. It's very beautiful.
This is a really interesting passage. If I don't know if you watch late night TV, Jon Stewart and Jay Leno before used to do this. David Letterman, they'd hit the street, you know, a lot of times with their religion question. Do you know about, you know, a question from the Bible? And most Americans would say, oh, yeah, I know that, and they're almost always wrong. All right? If you were to put that out on the street and kind of say, and say you know, what religious tradition does this come from? How many people would say, you know, if you were to bring it out and if you were to just read this without any other information, would you assume it was the Quran?
No.
Based on our media messaging, how does this go against what we often get in the media portrayal of Muslims?
Well, they call us all infidels and we're all, you know, horrible sinners and they want to kill us all.
Right. Muslims
and don't they oppress women?
Yeah, there are a lot of assumptions about Muslims in the West,
yeah.
that they're oppressors of women, that they have violent texts, and that we don't. Christians having such a long, glorious history of egalitarianism, yeah. as we found.
What does it mean by signs of God?
Signs of God, in some ways, this is how you know that God exists. This is, and sometimes sign is that, sometimes sign is gift. Among these gifts of God, or signs, and it can often mean both pieces. Arabic in the Quran is notoriously difficult to translate, right? So a lot of times these words are multivalent. In other words, they have a richness of meaning that it can extend beyond one word in English. But yeah, so sort of these show you that God is there and cares. These are gifts from God. Right? So diversity of languages and complexions as a sign of God, a gift from God. All these are really interesting.
It's interesting, there's a language that, you know, when Jesus says they will know you are Christians by your love. It's an image of, you know, the human interaction becomes a sign of God's presence.
Right.
And that's the language here.
Yeah, similar. Marriage. And if you fear you may not be able to do justice by the orphans, and I need to clarify that phrase, there is a lot of talk about orphans in the Quran and in Islamic texts, care for the orphans. One of the ways that Muhammad did that was to bring them into his household and then marry them. All right, because that gives you a place in society. right? So, and often that might be the case. So that's the preface to that. It says, if you're not able to do that, then marry women who please you. 2, 3, or 4. So 1, 2, 3, or 4 wives. This is the rule in Islam. But if you fear you may not be able to treat them equitably, then marry one. All right? Or a ward in your custody. That would be more fitting so that you do not go awry. And give the women their dowries as gifts. But if they favor you with anything from it of their own accord, then enjoy it as wholesome and salutary. So there are some legal rights that women have there. Often, Muhammad and his wives, I think he had 11 wives. There's been a lot of conversation about that, especially in modern times. After the time of Muhammad, it was sort of narrowed down to these four, having 4 wives. But often, this idea was that he would marry women who didn't have protectors.
Why marry instead of taking them as wards?
Because marriage gives them a certain status and place of and guarantees inheritance.
Because some of the wives were quite young, weren't they?
Some of them, yeah.
Okay.
But he was young. He was only 22.
He was young for part of it, but yeah, I mean, he collected. But yeah, the sense is, it's not something that we would look upon today and say, wow, this is a really great system. Mm-hmm. But if you were here last week, David did, my husband did the Book of Ruth, and when you have women who do not have male family members, they're like sitting ducks in ancient culture. You need sort of a father or a husband to guarantee that somebody will watch out for your interests. That was sort of the way things went in the ancient world. So the system was already set up against women in many ways. But this is one way of dealing with it. Men and women. Men are in charge of women. Because Allah has made the one to excel the other, and because they spend of their property for the support from women. You know it's too good to last, right? So good women and obedient, guarding in secret that which Allah has guarded. As for those from whom you fear rebellion, women, all right, admonish them and banish them to beds apart. And scourge them. It's usually beat them. Then, if they obey, do not go against them. And if you fear a breach between the man and the wife, appoint an arbiter from his folk and an arbiter from her folk. If they desire reconciliation, Allah will make them of one mind. So, a mixed bag.
Yeah.
All right. What we're going to take a look at in the next chunk, those are pieces of the Quran. Those are the highlights from the Quran in terms of the stories of the creation of humans. Any surprises there for you in having, before today, how many of you have read significant portions of the Quran or have spent time on it? All right then. So this is sort of your first sort of walk into those texts. Any surprises, anything, when you think about it now, do they disturb any stereotypes you might have had? Is it different than you thought they would be?
How beautiful the language was supposed to be. I heard a talk from a Muslim speaker when I was in high school, and his portion was mostly just about the beauty and the poetry of the language and the sort of the traditions and how it really is a very inclusive, accepting type of religion, and mostly since we were a bunch of white Christian suburban kids, He told us about, oh, we believe in Jesus too. He was a prophet. It's cool. But just mostly about how beautiful the language is, but it's surprising how egalitarian it is.
Some of those texts, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially with other surprises. Is this what you expected in opening up the Quran?
I think the similarity to the Bible is the surprising thing.
You know, it's true. Actually, it would be great to do a study, maybe another year at Holden, I will actually bring some of these texts in and do a day where we read the Joseph story in Genesis, and then we read the version in the Quran. I have my students in Intro to Biblical Studies or Intro to Old Testament do that as one of their assignments, and we talk about it and go through it. I've asked my students, which to reflect your faith more closely, or your idea of God is actually the one, your idea of God. And usually about 90% say, hang on. And not because they want to. They're shocked. They're like, because God in the Quran is often far more involved in the lives of some of those characters in the Joseph story. It's a very hands-off sort of thing. So my students are shocked by that. They're like, how could it be? I just didn't know. So it sounds more like Bible to me than Bible. All right. We're going to move on to another text. Now, this one is going to get a lot dicier, right? In terms, very, very similar in ways of text that we read yesterday, but it's a different take on the Ibn Adam story from one of the later Muslim commentators. And this one comes from, it's Al-Kisai. It's called Legends of Adam and Eve. It's about 1200 CE, all right? So sort of right in the Middle Ages, okay? I have 30 copies, and so if you grab one of those, all you need is one sheet.
Now, this is not the Quran.
This one's not the Quran. I put the Quran up there because there are smaller chunks, so you can see it. This one is a commentary, all right? And you see a lot of influences from Christian tradition, and especially the Jewish tradition in this one.
This is also written in Arabic.
Yes, written in Arabic.
This is going to be hard.
It's a little, it's tricky to see, but we'll do what we can. At least you have it in front of you, and I'll read the highlights as picture. Yeah, if you put your light on, we actually are.
Was this then oral tradition?
This one was not oral tradition because it's medieval period. A lot of this may be based on oral tellings before, but these were written down. These were,
but not until
1200, right? So, and probably influenced by all kinds of different things. And we see a lot of things in here that you don't see in the Quran, all right? And so you see some interesting characters develop. Let's take a look at this first one. It's the creation of Eve. While Adam slept, God created Eve from one of his left ribs. How is this similar to the text we did yesterday? They wanted to know about the rib, and you see some of that same curiosity about the text. Left ribs, which was crooked.
Awesome.
Now we get into some of those sorts of things that you didn't see in the Quran, they come back in these commentaries. A crooked rib. And this is going to be really important to remember. She was called Eve, or Hawa, is Chava in Hebrew, because she was made from a living being. What's interesting is that they're bringing in some of these older Jewish traditions especially, and some Christian ones. Well, the Quran itself doesn't say this about a crooked rib or, all those sorts of things.
Well, so in the Quran it says that they were both created from dust. So in the Quran is supposed to be flawless. How do they get away with?
It's the same sort of thing that you have in all of the traditions. Paul says in his, he picks pieces of the story. Paul gathers from his reading that women are not made in the image of God. It's a selective reading. It's a selective use of traditions. We all do it. It's so easy to point out in other people, though. It's great because we can see it and we're clear about it. I sometimes wonder, what am I not seeing? What is, but you're exactly right. And this is called Tales of the Prophet. It's not second, or it doesn't have the status of Quran. It's a collection of stories. And it's important because this is was very widely known, and these are probably the stories people told alongside the Quran. Second paragraph, this is great. Eve was as tall and as beautiful as Adam, and had 700 tresses studded with gems of crystallite and incensed with musk. Beautiful. 700. She was in the prime of her life. Similar, Judaism had Adam at about 20. She had large dark eyes. She was tender and white. Her palms were tinted. Yeah, probably the henna. And her long, shapely, brilliantly colored tresses, which formed a crown, emitted a rustling sound. She was of the same form as Adam, except that her skin was softer and purer than his was. And her voice was more beautiful. Her eyes were darker, her nose more curved, and her teeth were whiter than his were. When memorizing texts, sometimes, and remember, images were also a problem within the Islamic tradition, you've got to write your images if you can't paint them. So you can imagine them. What is our perfect woman? And there you've got her. Right? When God created her, he seated her at Adam's side. Adam saw her in his sleep on that long ago day. He loved her in his heart. Right. Oh Lord, he said, who is this? She is my handmaiden, Eve, God says. Oh Lord, said Adam, for whom hast thou created her? For one who will take her in trust and will persevere in thanks for her, said God. Then Adam said, oh Lord, I will take her on one condition, that you marry me to her. And so Adam was married to Eve before entering paradise. How is this different than some of the things that we've read so far?
Eve's not an ape anymore.
She's not an ape! She's more beautiful and the same size. What else? He bargained for, he begged for her. He begged, oh Lord. And what else do we learn about it? He loved her.
He wanted to get married right away.
He wanted to get married right away. Do you notice the attitude toward marriage? This is going to become, as in Judaism, there is not the negative attitude about marriage. Both traditions seem to be aware that marriage isn't always perfect, but the idea of it isn't shameful. It's not a negative institution.
So do you know, do they have lower rates of divorce?
I don't know if they've got lower rates of divorce. I think it's probably the same. It actually can get a divorce in Islam. Well, for most of Christianity, it's been prohibited. So within Judaism and Islam, there are rules that allow for divorce. Within Christianity, that's a very recent sort of thing.
Also, God calls Eve his handmaiden.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a prominent position.
Right.
She's not just something created.
And it was before entering paradise. They enter married. Which is very different because in a lot of the biblical, the sense is that, you know, they know each other once they leave Eden. Here, they're married before they go in. So in some ways, this, you kind of think, what would Augustine and Chrysostom have said in looking at these texts? What did Chrysostom say? You know, he was the one to cover her hair, shame, you know, Eve is shameful, those sorts of things. So we see some interesting pieces. Now, the serpent. This is the key figure that we see again in these stories in terms of blame. Iblis. And I marked these, you will see them on your sheets, where just with little brackets. At that time, the serpent was shaped like a camel. Right? And like the camel could stand erect. She, what happened? Serpent has become a she. She had a multicolored tail, red, yellow, green, white, black, and a mane of pearl, hair of topaz, eyes like the planets Venus and Jupiter, and an aroma like musk. Blended with abricus. Similar to Eve.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting.
A seductress,
all right. But like a camel, I can't get, but we're speaking of the, you know, the desert peoples. Camels are, you know, and as I read this to my husband, and I brought home some pictures from Egypt, and he said, this is just like those pictures you brought home of camels. Really brightly colored, woven sorts of blankets and things like that. Because I sent some even home by email when I was there, and they just had this really cool look to them. He goes, that's what it must be they must be thinking of. Makes sense now. Her dwelling was in the aqueous paradise, and her pond was on the shore of the river Kafar. Her food was saffron, and she drank from that river, and her speech was an exaltation of God, the Lord of the universe. God had created her 2,000 years before he created Adam. And she had told Adam and Eve about every tree in paradise. Got the setup. Beautiful camel? All right, so here we go. But Iblis spoke from the serpent's mouth. This is really, this is like the Christian tradition, that idea of the serpent and the, or the camel, as it may have been, and Satan being connected. That seems to have been a pretty significant idea in Judaism as well. Oh, Eve, beauty of paradise. Haven't I been with you in paradise and told you about everything that is here? Haven't I told you the truth and all I have said to you? So this is Satan speaking through the camel now. Yes, said Eve, I've only known you to be truthful in your speech. Eve, said Iblis, tell me what God permitted to you of this paradise and what he forbade you. And she told him what God had forbidden them. Why did your Lord forbid you the tree of eternity? Now it's the tree of immortality. This is a little bit like the very first story we looked at on the first day, the Gilgamesh epic, where he was getting the buckthorn of immortality. I do not know, said Eve.
I do not know.
But I know, cried Iblis. He forbade it to you because he wanted to make you like that slave whose place is under the tree of eternity and whom God brought to paradise 2,000 years before you. Eve jumped up from her daze to look at the slave, whereupon Iblis leapt out of the serpent's mouth like a streak of lightning and sat down under the tree. Eve saw him and thought he was the slave. So he's a shapeshifter, as my son would say. Right? Calling to him, she asked him, who are you? I am a creature of my Lord who created me from fire. I have been in paradise 2,000 years. He created me as he created you with his own hand and breathed his breath into me. Interesting. This one, it seems as if, you know, you have mixed of stories. Like, she could have had breath breathed into her. He caused the angels to bow down before me. Then he established me in paradise and forbade me to eat from this tree. I did not eat from it until one of the angels, who swore to me that he was giving me good advice, told me to do so, saying that whosoever ate from it would have everlasting life in paradise. I trusted him and ate from it. And as you can see, I am still in paradise. And have been saved from old age, illness, death, and expulsion. 2,000 years and counting, he says. All right. So then he goes on to quote, then he cried to her, Eve, eat of it. It is good and edible, the fruits of paradise. Hurry and eat before your husband Adam. For whoever eats first will have precedence over his companion. Now we're starting to see, they're placing some different motives here. Then Eve said to the serpent, you have been with me since I entered this paradise, but you have not told me anything about this tree. And the serpent was silent, fearing Ridwan, other demons, and desirous of the words Iblis had promised to teach. Thereupon Eve, that next set of brackets, bright with good news, came to Adam and told him of the serpent and the person who had sworn to her that he was giving her sound advice. Guess what? What is this answer? Where was Adam in the garden according to the biblical text? He was next to her. This clears up one of those sorts of things. She has to go and look for him because they're also probably concerned about that idea of them being side by side. Why didn't he say anything? Why didn't he do anything? So Eve drew near to the tree. It had innumerable branches, and on each branch were ears that contained seeds like the tel hujur, or, as it is also said, like ostrich eggs. They had fragrance like musk and were whiter than milk and sweeter than honey. Eve plucked 7 ears from 7 branches of the tree, ate one, and hid one away. The other 5 she took to Adam. Flip over to see what she's going to do. Then Adam took the ears from her hand, having forgotten the covenant binding upon him, and tasted of the tree as Eve had done. All right. And the story would go on to point out then they were, you know, God said, what did you do? All right. But this kind of gives an interesting setup of what's going on. What do we notice as these stories continue to develop from like maybe early part of Judaism and as we move to the, like I said, these are by about 1200. What kinds of details do you see being added?
What the fruit was like.
Yeah, what the, and it's like those sorts of, like exactly how many branches, all these other pieces. What are the kinds of details are popping out?
Genders for the serpent.
Yeah, a gender change. Mm-hmm. Yeah, before it was even popular.
2,000 years instead of 7 days.
Yes, 2,000 years, exactly. It's, I've been here, right? You can see this serpent developing a relation and really tricking Eve so that she is truly tricked, she doesn't know. All right, there's not a sense that she should have known better. All right? Yeah,
but you still have her, I mean, there's, the she's giving in to temptation to be better by being the first one to be better, and whatever she's going to do with the one she's kept. I mean, there's some deceitfulness. So she, you know, given to her.
So you see some of those pieces coming out too. And you see Chris's boot. Yep.
Oh, in this one, it doesn't seem like the serpent is actually, you know, evil necessarily. Like the serpent was her friend, but then Satan, or the Iblis, spoke through its mouth.
Yes.
So even that's a trick. The serpent itself may still be her friend.
Exactly. So the serpent itself is not evil. So we kind of see the blame shifting around. And where's Adam in this one? How significant is he to this story? Not much, at least in this version. He has a small play, a small walk-on role told him toward the end. But yes, yeah, so you can see some of the greed, some of the sorts of things. What does she want? She wants precedence. You see in all of these stories, there's this real tension over power. We've been noticing that, kind of, like who's going to have the power? And we wonder if this is something that, you know, the modern world has kind of developed. Are we the only one concerned about gender equity? These are old texts, and they're all talking about power. And these are men writing these texts talking about power. I wonder what is going on that you have all of these men really concerned about maintaining power in each of these sorts of things and worried about women getting it. You have to kind of say what's going on in their society at the same at the time. We do know that there were powerful women in antiquity. We don't know a lot about them, but they exist. If we go to Muhammad himself, his first wife. Does anybody remember her name? I just blanked on it. I was going to it'll come to me. At any rate, she was much older, up to 20 years older than he was. She was, I believe, a widow, and she had a lot of wealth. She funded him. She launched him. Yeah, 20 years older. Exactly. So sort of like the Demi Moore and Madonna. Yeah. Before it happened. But she was the, because he did not come from means. And so it looks as if she got him. This is also the case when you take a look at early Christianity. From your studies of the New Testament, the beginnings of Christianity, who foot the bill? Who did? I mean, do you remember? A lot of these women, wealthy women who opened their homes and bankrolled the movement. What happens to those women once the movement gets going? Once a hierarchy develops, often those women, so it's sort of like when there's a moment of where everybody, all hands on deck, right? I think of it as a time similar that, at least in our history, World War II in the United States, what kinds of things did women start doing that they hadn't done before? Yeah, Rosie, you know? But women were in factories, women were doing a lot of stuff because they, all hands on deck. It had to be done. What happened at the end of the war? Where did they say, thank you, go home to your cookies. Yeah, kind of an interesting sort of phenomenon, but you get this in different periods of history. When something big is at, you know, sort of in the works, you get everybody there. Once you kind of got it working, it's kind of an interesting piece. Yeah, but you have this too, so you kind of have these power sorts of things. There's one, oh, we're at 7:15, so we should close up. There's one last piece here that's kind of interesting. In the Quran, there is a piece in Judaism I did not bring in, but in the Quran you have some texts where Eve speaks, where the texts are put in her mouth. My God and Master, it is mine own sin which I was made to do. She in this one gets to actually claim it. How is this is different than in the other traditions? She says, I did it. What does she do in the biblical text?
He gave it.
The serpent. Yep. Iblis led me astray with this. She says what happened, but she claims it. With his deception and evil whisperings, and swore to me by thy majesty that he was advising me well. I never thought on that he would swear by thee if he were lying. But it's interesting that she starts out, it's my fault. I just didn't realize. Now here's what God says. Depart now from paradise, deceived forever henceforth. So you will always be deceived. This is similar to some of those Christian texts that we took a look at. Said God, I make thee deficient in mind, religion, ability to bear witness, and inheritance. I make thee morally malformed with glazed eyes, and make thee to be in prison for the length of days in life, and deny thee the best things. The Friday congregation, that means worship in the public setting, mingling in public, and giving greeting. I destine thee to menstruation and the pain of pregnancy and labor, and thou wilt give birth only by tasting the pain of death along with it. Women shall experience more sorrow, more tears shall flow from them, they will have less patience, and God will never make a prophet or a wise person from among them.
This isn't part of the Quran.
It's not part of the Quran.
So how much power does it have in Islam?
It doesn't. What it tells us is it reflects women's roles in society. That's what a lot of these texts, that's what Augustine was doing. They're all saying these same kinds of things. They, in terms of, to do two things, describe what they see and to enforce the status quo.
Are these familiar to Muslims?
To some Muslims, and for periods of history, these would have been quite familiar. These were the popularly told stories.
But today?
Some, yeah. It's just like Christianity when you say, do people know these stories?
But we could take or leave Augustine, not especially some of the women parts.
It's easy to say, but if you're Catholic, you can't. If you're Protestant, if you're Lutheran, much of Luther's theology is based on Augustine. So we can't take him or leave him quite so easily as we might think. You know, you're right. So these aren't dictating law. These are telling us some of the attitudes that were there. Alright? And this spells them out pretty clearly. Similar to what we've seen in all of these traditions. I won't go through this last one, but it is interesting because it continues to go. Eve began to question. She says, my God, you didn't create me from a crooked rib bone. Exactly. Because it's that, she's going back to the beginning. You created me from a crooked rib bone. I think we need to talk. So really interesting text. Like I said, tomorrow we're going to try to bring all this stuff together. Where are we now? Where can we go from here? And we're going to start out with some fantastic letters from a woman named Sarah Grimke in the early 1800s, who was really pivotal in the abolitionist movement, so against slavery, but she also wrote some really powerful words about women and about reading scripture. She said, in one of her lines, I'm all for following the Bible. She wrote this, like I said, 1838. She said, but it has been distorted. And we need to write some new commentaries. See you tomorrow.